When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello everyone, and welcome to another episode of Flushing is Burning. As always, I'm Grace. I'm recording this on Thursday, March 14th, late at night, 10:48 at night. We've got about an hour and 12 minutes until the new MLB The Show game comes out, so I'm both wired and exhausted. In terms of baseball news this week, you know, we're still sort of in the dead zone of like the middle of spring training. There's been a lot of talk lately, I think, about because I think you get to this point every season, spring training. A lot of talk about, is spring training too long? And it specifically seems to always crop up at this point in spring training. And I think that the issue is that it's not that it's too long, because I think the players, especially the pitchers, need like this extended ramp up time. I think the issue is that, like, it's just boring because there's nothing to play for, so people are just bored and they're looking for a fix to that boredom. And I think that sometimes we need to learn to sit with the boredom. Tomorrow is going to be kind of exciting in terms of baseball, at the very least. It's going to be if you listen to this, you're a Mets fan, whatever they're calling it, the spring breakout games, I believe. Each team, it looks like, is getting one, I believe, or most teams, some teams, I don't know. There's quite a few teams getting these. The Mets are one. They're playing the Nationals. And it's a prospect versus prospect game, which should be fun and interesting. We'll get to see some of the big names that are floating around in terms of Mets prospects against some of the big named Nationals prospects. So that should be pretty fun. Maybe we'll see some Dylan Cruz and James Wood and all the other prospect that they have. They don't actually have that many. They did a trade for like Juan Soto and yeah, they got a million people in it, but like CJ Abrams is already in the majors, you know what I'm saying? Anyway, for the Mets, Brett Beatty was actually a late scratch from the game the other day. He's dealing with some sort of back tightness, I believe they called it, and McNeil's still not back with his whole arm situation. Although they're hoping he will get back in games soon, this weekend or so. I'm not loving the Mets. They're also talking to JD Martinez and JD Davis, the JDs. I think if they sign one of them, it's probably more likely to be, actually, I don't know who would be more likely to be, right? Because I think Martinez would cost more money and that would sort of be prohibitive, although Colin has said, oh, go for it or whatever, but I don't know. I still don't see that happening. I just can't picture it. And maybe it'll happen, but who knows? I could see more likely in that respect it being JD Davis, because he's going to cost less money, but also I don't know that he wants to come back to New York is the thing, right? So I don't know. We'll see what happens. I just really don't want to have to watch Mark Vientos play third base, which he's not having a good spring training. Is it on Baseball Reference, the spring stats? I feel like they're on there, like, at the forefront, and then as soon as the season starts, you have to, like, enter a complicated, you know, puzzle to find them. Let's see. Mark Vientos. Yeah, here we go, spring stats. So he is hitting, 206, 250... 500, 750 OPS, 3 home runs, 3 RBIs. He's had 7 hits and 34 at-bats. 7. And 3 of those were home runs. 1 was a double. And he's had 8 strikeouts. That's what you want. You always want to, you know, that's the vibe you want to have. But he is, yeah, his on base percentage is a 250. Doesn't just start with a 2, it starts with a 2.5. I know that a lot of people are holding out hope he's going to be some sort of major contributor. I just don't see it. I think what's scarier for me, though, right? Because we know kind of what he's going to be, and there seems to be, like, some hope of an improvement, you know? Like there's a potential there. I haven't seen many people talk about this. Starling Marte looks like dog shit. Like, this is not great. Not what you want. I'm looking at stats right now. In 23 plate appearances, 22 at bats. He has 2 hits, 2 RBI, and 3 strikeouts. He's batting 091. It doesn't just start, it did like 091. His on base percentage starts with a 1. His slugging is 091 too, because he doesn't have any extra base hits. The projections on Baseball Reference are really hopeful. I don't believe that he's going to bat 275. I'm scared. He's 35, right? And he's had steroid stuff, and he's had major groin issues last years. I'm a little scared of two different scenarios. One is that they have to cut him, like they did Robinson Cano at some point in May or June or whatever, and then they have dead money on the books next year, right? Because that's not what you want. I'm also scared that they, because they don't want to have dead money, keep him and DH him, because he has not looked good in the outfield either. Because if he can't hit, I feel like he shouldn't be your designated hitter. And I feel like when he signed, everyone, the conversation seemed to be, well, he signs, and yeah, like, you want him to be a starter all 4 years, but, you know, he might have to move to the bench by year 4, you know, he's going to be 36 or whatever. He's not even benchable in spring. Like, this is horrendous. This is not major league quality at in any retrospect. And it's, I mean, it's sad to watch it, but it's just, it's not good. And I want to just check too, because, you know, again, we've talked about all of our DH people, and DJ Stewart is in fact there as well, and he's hitting 182. And his slugging is 182, which will tell you that there were no extra base hits. He's walked twice, which is nice. Yeah, he's got 462 OPS. Maybe they should sign JD Martinez. Yeah. So that's sort of the Met vibe right now with third base and DH. In terms of pitching, the Minaya and Severino have looked pretty good, as have Jose Budo, and as much as it pains me to say, Tyler McGill, but my guess is Tyler McGill gets the number 5 spot since Senga's hurt. I don't know that I can physically watch more Tyler McGill starts. I've been out on Tyler McGill since this August of 2021. And I haven't felt any better about him at any point. I remember saying at the end of 2021, he could go into the Hall of Fame. And I still would be like, I'm not convinced, right? Because I had a historically bad run of seeing him. I don't know if I ever said this on here. In 2021, me and my dad had a 20-game pack. And 2021, you know, it was messed with because of the COVID and everything. So we were only allowed back, I think, in, like, June were our first tickets, or maybe late May. And because of this, our 20 games were sort of truncated. So we went to a lot of games in those, like, 4 months or whatever. And we saw in a row, and I'm not kidding, we saw, I think, 5 or 6 Tyler McGill starts. And each one was worse than the last. I think there was one where he didn't give up at least 6 runs. And it was, it was the Subway Series game. I think the Friday night Subway Series game, and I think he gave up like 1 run or 2 runs, and I was like, oh, okay, I'm not. And then I think we saw him again the next game, and it was terrible. I'm actually curious. I'm doing a lot of Baseball Reference chat because there's not a lot of baseball stuff going on right now. Let's go to Tyler McGill's page, because I want to find exactly game logs, pitching 2021. Okay, if I see the dates, I'll remember them. Okay, so first one we saw him was against the Dodgers. So we went to the game against Dodgers. The game against the Giants. That was terrible. We also, at that game, there was some lady sitting next to us, and her and her husband were saying the most racist things about Francisco Lindor in, like, that condescending way, like racist, but not, like, outright racist, you know, like, sort of like that, well, I wonder if, like, this is racist, but I'm not saying, like, they weren't saying slurs, but they were saying, like, I don't think he can speak English that well. And I was like, lady, have you even listened to him talk? He can, in fact, speak English that well. So we went Dodgers, Giants, Dodgers, Giants, were we at the Nationals game? I can't remember. We were definitely at the Mets game, and Dodgers, Giants, Yankees, St. Louis we were definitely at as well, because that was Roberto Clemente Day. Yeah, and I think we were at that Washington game too, which, like, that game he didn't give up a ton of runs, but yeah, it was just an ass line. But yeah, it's just like, I can't do any more Tyler Miguel. Well, I've talked for 10 minutes already. I have so many more points. Gerrit Cole had a mystery arm injury. He went to literally Dr. Tommy John. Dr. Neil the Elitreche, I believe his name is, or something like that. The news just broke as I was getting home few minutes ago. He's not going to need Tommy John. He may only need to miss 1 or 2 months with rest, conservative rehab. But yeah, not great. And also the stuff I've seen is very filled with, like, fluid phrasing. He may only need it to take a month or two. He doesn't need Tommy John as of right now, you know, like, stuff like that. But who does need Tommy John is Lucas Giolito. He's going to miss all of this season and part of next, based on him getting the Tommy John surgery, I think, 2 weeks ago. It's a, you know, 12 to 18 month recovery, so the assumption is that he'll probably miss part of next season. And I think there's some sort of clause in his deal with the Red Sox I saw that activates a third year in there, I think. I'm not positive. What's really interesting with the Cole one is there is that opt-out. I can't imagine, I can't imagine him not pulling the trigger on that now, unless the Yankees say no to adding the extra year, because it's a fake opt-out. But the Tommy John stuff sort of throws a weird wrinkle in it, because I think he's like 33, so he'd be coming back when he's like 34, maybe 35, you know, like, if he doesn't need Tommy John, he'll be back this year. If he does, I don't know, it's going to be very interesting to see what happens with that. The Padres traded for Dylan Cease. Sure, kind of weird that they traded Juan Soto away and then it made a move that made it look like they're trying to contend. I get that they need pitching, but most of who they traded in that package was guys that they had already had, other than Drew Thorpe. The Juan Soto thing was a money dump, is clearly what was going on here, because they're clearly cash poor after Seidler's death, because I think that there's some sort of weird, like, they're trying to figure out where the money goes. Very interesting operation going on over there. You think they would have, like, and also he was sick, I believe. You think he would have planned ahead of that? I don't know. The Braves signed Adam Duvall today. I think that this was the signal that they did not like what they saw from Jared Kelnick in spring training. And I'm interested because I've seen that it's not good, but I'm interested to see what that actual line is. So let's click on Jared Kelnick. What a fall off. He is hitting 0.88 in spring training. 3 hits, 3 RBI, 9 strikeouts. Jesus. 184 on base percentage. Jeez Louise. Yeah, I don't blame them for not wanting to run him out there. Yeah, makes sense. But other than that, yeah, it's been a kind of slow baseball news time. I don't know. We'll see. We'll see if anything picks up. But really, at this point, I mean, next week we'll have the Soul Series to talk about, which is on the 20th and 21st between the Padres and the Dodgers. Games at 6 a.m. Who doesn't love that? yeah, I mean, other than that, in 2 weeks' time, it's going to be opening day. We'll have an idea of who's on the Mets roster, although we kind of already have that idea, but we'll, you know, have a better idea of that by then, hopefully. Something will have happened with J.D. Martinez and J.D. Davis. Like, they'll have signed somewhere. We'll be able to talk about that. Hopefully by that time, Snell and Montgomery will have signed. Yeah, it's a weird time. We haven't talked about that. Snell and Montgomery, still out there. Yankees said, you know, the word got out, the Yankees aren't likely to try for Snell, so that takes a team out of the running for him. Red Sox could really use Montgomery, but they're committed to just we tried every person this offseason. So other than that, why don't we take a little break, and when we come back, I'm going to talk about the Oscars that just happened. All right, and we're back. So I gave my predictions last week, and I was right on all of them except for one. We'll get to that in a minute. I'm going to do the good and the bad from the show. So the good, other than the one I was wrong about, which I don't hate that win, but I think it's the clear number three in the category. And I consider a win good if it's going to be the top two. You know, other than that, like, I mean, clearly the one I was wrong about was Lily Gladstone. Emma Stone won. I think this is the second Oscar that she didn't deserve for the performance. It's very odd. Very, very odd. If she had never won before, I think I probably would have been a lot happier with this result. Because it'd be like, well, she, you know, she's deserved one for a while. So many good performances. But, like, I don't know. I rewatched Poor Things last week. And I talked about this last week at the time, too. I didn't love it. On the second watch. First time, I thought I really liked it, but there were, like, things that were second time. It didn't click with me, and I think the issue with Emma Stone's performance, I mean, I know I said I was going to do the good stuff, but I'm just going to talk about this, because it is an acting winner. It's such a big performance in the way that needs to be, but when you do that, there's a very fine line, and I don't even fault her for this, because it's one of those things that, like, you almost can't avoid. It becomes too big, becomes camp, becomes everything like that. But other than Emma Stone, I mean, Divine Joy Randolph winning added years on my life that Emma Stone winning took away again. It was a great, you know, 2.5 hours that I had those extra years. Cillian Murphy's win is one of the best in the category in a long time. Like, if you go look at the best actor winners at the Oscars, and the 2010s were so dire. And this decade, my hot take is I'm not the world's biggest fan of The Father. And I wouldn't have given it to Anthony Hopkins. I love Anthony Hopkins, but that was, if all things being fair, I would have voted for Chadwick Boseman, but all things being fair, that was Riz Ahmed's Oscar, and, you know, I think he gave far and away the best performance. And Steven Yeun is great in that year, too. Like, you know, like, it was just a surprisingly good year for actor, and I just didn't love. And again, they didn't rearrange the show for that, and then he won. It would have been a different story, but we have to go with what we're given. Will Smith, whatever, he didn't deserve it. Brendan Fraser, man. That was just, that's rough. And he is so likable, but that's just a rough win. But, like, Cillian Murphy, that is a very quiet, introspective performance that they typically don't go. I mean, look at who won lead actress. That's not a quiet performance. That's what's really weird to me, because Divine Joy Randolph, Cillian Murphy, and Robert Downey Jr. gets a little bit big as Strauss, but it's not that big. It is a lot of, like, internalized stuff that I think, if you look at the group of winners this year, it's a good group of winners, but I think Emma Stone sticks out in a weird way because her performance is so big. It's so big. Yeah. But yeah, Cillian Murphy, great winner. Robert Downey Jr., you know, great to see. And I also want to say this. So many people got so pissed off this year about the different acceptances or whatever. The pictures backstage, whatever, I don't think Robert Downey Jr. and Emma Stone were purposefully snubbing Kaylee Kwan and Michelle Yeoh, respectively. I think it's just one of those. I mean, Michelle Yeoh said that she handed the Oscar to Jennifer Lawrence so that Jennifer Lawrence, who is Emma Stone's friend in real life, good friend, could hand her the Oscar, right? I think it's just one of those things that you have to, especially for Robert Downey Jr. This man has almost died. He has had to do two different dramatic comebacks, right? Because, like, the first comeback was from prison and drugs, and the second comeback was from years and years in the Marvel movies where he was kind of just stuck in neutral, you know? So he finally gets the award that he's clearly wanted. I mean, he's been nominated. This was his third nomination. And as cool and collected as he was up on that stage, I doubt that's how he actually felt inside. You know, it's just one of those moments. It happens, you know? And again, because of the way that they did it, which I really liked, the production of the show this year was really good. And we'll get to that in a minute. Because of the way they did the acting stuff with the five presenters, it's kind of hard when you, like, you could see it was kind of hard to go up there, Killing Murphy did it, and thank each person, because where they sort of crowded around the stairs, so you'd walk up the stairs, you want to get the Oscar, like, you're supposed to take the Oscar, and that's one person, and then your friend is over here, and you're like, oh my god, or whatever. The people online have been insufferable about with the discourse about this. And I say that as someone who agrees with one of the main, points of contention of Best Actress. But even that, we've gone so psychotic over. It's not Emma Stone's fault. I'm sure it was very close based on the SAG. Like, this, her, you know, Lily winning the SAG. I think it was international. And I think that raises a whole different question. And that's a question that you raise when you look at the people who have historically won and been nominated for and won BAFTAs. Denzel Washington has never been nominated for a BAFTA award. That is a piece of, I don't want to say it's a fun fact, but it is a piece of information that I like to think to myself when I think about how the BAFTAs votes. And then obviously that's not the full international body, but there's a lot of BAFTA members in the regular Academy as well. And when you realize that, when you realize the people that they have snubbed, things become a lot clearer. I want to say, I'm just going to Google this real quick, but on a different note, a picture director, great wins. Regina King came back for this, which was great, and that's what I'm looking up right now. But great, great wins. I loved Al Pacino's, just could not be normal for 5 seconds. I love him. He is, if you don't have a good time watching Al Pacino be, like, you know, sort of just out there on stage. Like, what are we even doing here? Yeah, so Regina King wasn't nominated for a BAFTA. It's one of those things. They clearly have an issue with getting specifically American, but just generalized, people of color in that room, on that stage. And I think that is what ended up. And I think also the difference between Poor Things and Killers of the Flower Moon is Killers of the Flower Moon is such a distinctly American story that is, not that other nations don't have similar aspects of their history, but that is so specific to America that British people wouldn't really be able to relate to in that sense. You know, I watch that and I see my country reflected back at me. If you're a British person, you're not going to see that, but you're going to see Emma Stone doing, you know, everything that she does in that movie, and you go, oh, well, I can get that. I understand that. So, you know, it's one of those things that I think actually there needs to be some reflection on the way that the more international parts of the Academy, and by international at this point, I really just mean European, how they vote. But the production of the show was great. I loved the actors crowding around and each giving a little thing, although some of them were really earnest to the point that was like the Nick Cage Paul Giamatti one I thought was great. I loved that. But you've got, like, I forget who it was who was saying for, like, Sterling K. Brown, they were like, oh, they were like really waxing poetic over his performance, and I was like, probably should have made that one a more funny one, because like you're sitting there going, the depth and the you know, all this stuff that you brought to this role created this complex. I'm like, he's on screen for like 20 minutes. And I liked Sterling K. Brown. That was the world's stupidest nomination. So it's like he got nominated because people liked him, right? Like that was the thing. Because that should have been the Charles Melton spot. And you could wax poetic about that. But the production show was great. I loved the, obviously, I'm Just Ken, number of the night. I also loved the song from Hills Flower Moon, which I'm not going to attempt to pronounce the name of the song because I know I'm going to butcher it. And, but Scott George. And it was so incredible. I remember they played it. And afterwards, I was talking to my dad about the Oscars afterwards because he had went out during the show. And I'm like, that nomination is one of the coolest nominations to me. That song got nominated. In what, like, what pre, you know, Cheryl Boone Isaacs, we're going to diversify the Academy. What world does that song get in? It doesn't. You know? It would be some stupid, it would be the other Diane Warren song would have gotten in, which I loved that song and the song from American Symphony, sort of basically them being like, listen, no one cares, pack it up. And like them getting like 30 seconds. It was great. The Flaming Hot Cheetos Children Choir. But yeah, the production show was great. Speeches, a lot of great speeches. Dave Andre Randolph had me sobbing as well as Paul Giamatti. I thought Court Jefferson's speech really struck a chord. No pun intended. Really struck a chord with me. The way he said, you know, that no one wanted. He'd been talking about this all award season. That no one had wanted to finance film. That it was too big of a risk. And that, you know, if, you know, this is a risk, but so are the $200 million movies. Why don't you make a few less $200 million movies, disperse that money among like $10 million and $5 million movies, and you can make a bunch of those, and then like you're going to hit on one or two of them at least. And I thought that was great. And I also want to single out, and there's been discourse about this too, I think that the best speech of the night, the bravest speech of the night, was Jonathan Glazer. You could see his hands shaking as he made that speech, and behind him, one of the producers of the films is a Russian oligarch who is very pro-Israel, and he got up there. And what I loved about Glazer's speech was, and I think people misinterpreted it as both sides in the issue, was sort of saying that this occupation led to the deaths and the attacks that occurred on October 7th, as well as the continuing assaults now. All of this is a result of the occupation that's been happening for decades. And that's what the issue is here. And you could see him shaking or whatever. And for a night where you had, you had the little red artist for Ceasefire Pins, which are great. Mark Ruffalo was on the red carpet saying stuff. And if he had won, I have no doubt that he would have said something in his speech. And Rami Youssef wearing it and talking about it on the red carpet was great. But, you know, you had people go up there wearing the pin and then say nothing, you know? And Glazer getting up there and saying that. And the fact that you had Swan Arlode and Milo Machado Grainer wearing actual pins that just had the Palestine flag on it. The international, you know, the people involved in these more international films are way more brave than the Americans were. And I thought that was kind of shameful that no one else said. Because if one other person said something in their speech, you know, yeah, thank your publicist, thank your stylist, thank this, thank that. People are dying. You know, there's huge protests before the show. People are dying. Say something, you know. We've reached this point where people are so afraid to say stuff. Go back and watch Vanessa Redgrave's speech, which people gave her a lot of shit for. She went up there, she was saying this shit 50 years ago. People are like, oh, don't say it. And look at where that got us. 50 years of not saying shit got us to here. The bands. I think Lily Gladstone losing the Oscar. Now, those of us with taste. If you like the Emma Stone performance, I get it. I get it. I don't personally love the movie or the performance. She's been number 3 in the category, I think. I talked about this last week. Lily Gladstone, Sandra Hüller. Who was great. I loved the moment where they singled her out for being in two Best Picture nominees. Yeah. Sandra Hüller is fantastic. I gotta watch. I saw a clip from Sybil this week, which was also directed by Justine Triet. I gotta watch that. She's great. She's so great. She just has this innate ability, like you know, we saw with I'm Just Kidding, Ryan Gosling gives 100%. She is so in it in every performance. It's fantastic. I didn't love Toni Erdmann. I thought she was fantastic. I remember that movie being over me going, who's that? She was great, you know. Lily Gladstone losing is a loss that we are going to, some of us are already doing it, but in like 5 to 10 years, people are going to look back and go, yeah, bad choice, you know, like, and it sucks because like, we're 8 years out. We were doing the same thing for Emma Stone's last one, right? Because like, La La Land's a good movie. Everyone loves La La Land. In what world did she deserve it? In that category that year, she's number 4. And the only reason why she's not number 5 is because that was like the Meryl Streep, Madeline In period. You know, somehow she got nominated for Florence Foster Jenkins. I'll never understand. But like, that year you had Isabelle Huppert, my personal choice, Natalie Portman and Jackie, or even, I thought Ruth Negga, and if I was ranking them, Ruth Negga would be like 2. And that's like kind of close to Portman in that. She's so great. Lily Gladstone losing, it sucked. Even Emma Stone didn't expect to win. She said herself. She literally did not expect to win. And I get it, because she just lost the SAG Awards. And remember last year, everyone won a fucking SAG, won an Oscar. Jamie Lee Curtis. But it sucks. It sucks for... The thing that I keep coming back to is people keep going, oh, well, she'll be back. Well, she'll be back. And I have a little more hope now, A, because of the friends that she's made, Three Killers. You know, now she has Martin Scorsese and Robert De Niro and Leonardo DiCaprio in her, you know, corner. And on this, you know, awards run, she's clearly become very good friends with Emma Stone. And, when you go to all these shows with the same people, you get to know them. So I have slightly more hope, but also... look at all of the people of color who did not win Oscars and look at their careers going forward, especially look at all the Native people who've been nominated for Oscars. That's a very short list. And look at their careers going forward. I don't think a single one has been nominated more than once. Now, I personally love Lily Gladstone, and I'm going to return to talking about how much I love Lily Gladstone later. And I think that if anyone were to be the first one to be nominated twice, it would be her. In the same way that Viola Davis, like, it should have been someone earlier, but if someone's going to do it now, of course she's going to be the Black woman most nominated for Best Actress. Has not won Best Actress yet. Different story for a different day. Probably should have, if she had run for Best Actress, if she had campaigned Best Actress for Fences, I 100% believe she would have won that Oscar. She would have done it. But they took the easy way out, which is what happens. I do want to say there has been this sort of debate with Lily Gladstone. I just want to check and see how long I'm going. Ooh. There's been this sort of debate with Lily Gladstone. She should have went supporting. What she did was smart. Even though she lost, what she did was smart, because she basically said, I am not your supporting actress. I'm your lead. And I will be seen as the lead. She lost, but she's the lead. And I think if you go and you watch Lily Gladstone's other performances, which The Unknown Country is streaming on Mubi, I gotta catch up with it later this year. Fancy Dance is gonna be on Apple, and I've only heard good things about it, and I'm probably gonna talk about it on the show, because Lily Gladstone, who is... in real life, because this is the other thing that came out of this year, actor and actress each had a out queer person in it, Coleman Domingo and Lily Gladstone. She plays queer in Fancy Dance as well. She plays queer in a lot of her movies, which is also in and of itself great. That is great for representation. But yeah, it was such a bummer, and especially like, it's the second to last award of the night. At makeup, I was like, uh-oh. And at production costume design, I literally sat there and I went, it's a coin toss now. It is a true, I was like 65-35 on Lily going in. When it won those three, it was 50-50. And as the night went on, I could feel myself losing more and more hope. And it just sucked. It sucked so much. One of my other things I don't like, I think Jimmy Kimmel is a perfectly cromulent Oscars host. 6 out of 10 Oscar host. Gets in there, does what he has to do. So it's annoying. The Killers of the Flower Moon joke. Too long joke. And just generally that line of jokes that he's been making now for like 10 years. Every time he goes to the Oscars, he makes the same fucking joke. That Killers of the Flower Moon one specifically was like, yeah, of course, Killers of the Flower Moon is 3 hours and 26 minutes long. How do you sum that story up shorter and not lose something? That movie is so affecting. I went and saw it last week before I recorded the show, I believe. It is so affecting. And I don't know, I'm just sick of that joke. You know, he stopped doing the nobody's seen these movies jokes, which is great. Because, like, how are you going to do that this year? No one's seen these movies. Oh, that's right. Poor Things made, like, $100 million, and Barbie made $1 billion, and Oppenheimer almost made $1 billion. You know, like, you can't really make those jokes that year. But we still got to fall back on the old familiars. I just felt it was so tasteless to do it for that movie, too. Because I think there's a difference between being like, oh, Avatar, too fucking long at 3 hours and 45 minutes. And Killers of the Flower Moon, doing it for Killers of the Flower Moon. Because Killers of the Flower Moon is a true story about a literal genocide that this country carried out. And you're like, oh, I have to get my mail forwarded to the theater. Jesus Christ, man. And then my one thing with the production I had a problem with was the speeches or whatever for each actor is great. You do miss the clips, because the thing was is that at the start my mom came out and watched a little bit with me, and supporting actress, it was just them talking about it. My mom hadn't seen any of the movies, so she sat there and she was like, what were they in, because they didn't say, you know, at the end. It would have even been better if before they opened the envelope they said, you know, one more time, the nominees are. Just because they sort of danced around a lot of it. They would say the name at a different point, you know. But I'm hoping, what I think this is a good format for is like once every 10 years, because you need like a new batch of people to sort of cycle through, otherwise you're just going to be doing a lot of the same people. So hopefully next year it's back to clips. I do really love the clips, because I like watching the movies and being like, what's the Oscar clip? And some of the awards, original song, picture, like the ones that they went through over the course of the night, they didn't read the nominees before they opened the envelope. It's just Al Pacino just going, my, I see Oppenheimer, you know. It's very like, that was funny, but like, and he came out and he was like, that was not my choice, you know, like, and I think that's hilarious. But yeah, I'd love to see them bring that back. But other than that, I thought it was good. I think it was one of the best Oscars just from a construction standpoint and with the winners that I'd seen in a very long time. And just finally, before we go, I just want to, we haven't really talked about it that much, and I might go further in depth with it next week, but I'm sure if you're listening to this, you've kept up with the whole Next Benedict stuff and the hate crime and today they said that what he did, and I'm using he because he had used he, him pronouns with, you know, friends and stuff like that. He hadn't introduced them into his family yet, but that was the way that he would have wanted to be referred to. They're currently ruling it a suicide, but he took a fatal combination of Prozac and Benadryl. And there's been some sort of debate on whether or not that people believe that or whatever, but we also have today J.K. Rowling going out there and talking about how the Nazis weren't actually burning books about trans people and trans medicine, trans research, which they were. And it makes me so sad to see all of this stuff, because you see, if whether or not it was a suicide or something else, Nex's death, because if it's a suicide, gee, I wonder why he was suicidal. And if it wasn't, gee, I wonder what would make someone want to kill a young trans person. Trans non-binary. Stuff like this comes out, and you still have the J.K. Rowlings and the Chaya Ray Chicker, the fuck you pronounce her name, coming out here and being like, well, I'm still right about trans people. And it's so baffling to me. Next Benedict was, what, 13 years old? 14 years old? It's like, I want to puke talking about it. It's just, these are kids. And people are constantly like, well, you can't let kids do stuff. All Nex had done was socially transition. There were no surgeries. There was nothing like that. Maybe he was on puberty blockers. Maybe. Right? But that would be it. These are children. And you are refusing to see the results of your actions and words. And we get so wrapped up in these culture wars of who's right and who's wrong that, much like regular wars, we completely disregard the collateral damage. And then in 20 years down the road, we're going to go, wow, we killed a lot of people that didn't need to die. And so I just want to say, and maybe next week I'll get into it more, but like I said, it makes me want to vomit. Because I think about when I was in school, which was not that long ago, but it was some time ago. And I think about how there were assholes at school, obviously. But I think I was so blessed to have such great friends, to have people around me that loved me and supported me and that I could talk to. But when I was Nex's age, I didn't have that many friends. And I think about if I was out at the time and if I was in a different area, because I'm from Long Island and Long Island is red, but I think it's a very specific kind of red where it's like red, but like socially just a smidgen more liberal, you know, like people can be gay and stuff isn't gonna like, they're not gonna die or whatever. But I just think about how alone he must have felt. Yeah, it's really tough. So I just want to say, you know, rest in peace to Nex, and I hope that this ends soon and that we see the humanity in each other. Although it's very difficult for us to do that now, apparently. So why don't we take a break? And when we come back, I'm going to do a short movie minute that I just rewatched that actually has one of the people I was talking about in our Oscar segment. All right. And we're back. So my movie minute, I just rewatched this because day after the Oscars, you know, I was a little bummed about that. Because again, Lily Gladstone thing was right at the last moment. So I was feeling a little bit bummed about that. And I thought, you know what? There's a movie that has Academy Award winner Laura Dern, Academy Award nominee Michelle Williams, Academy Award nominee Lily Gladstone, years before Killers of the Flower Moon came out, almost a decade before Killers of the Flower Moon, and Academy Award winner in my heart, Academy Award nominee, and my favorite actor ever, Kristen Stewart in it. And that is Certain Women. What I adore about Certain Women is one of those movies that you're gonna, you know, here's what I'm gonna say. You're gonna watch it, right? Like, you watch it, you sit down. First, it's broken up. It's like almost like an anthology thing, although there is like a slight bit of crossover. The first story, the first segment, is good. Laura Dern, Jared Harris, good. Second segment, Michelle Williams. Good. My dog loved that part. My dog sat there watching me. Laura Dern, Michelle Williams' part where she's walking and then she walks off screen. My dog followed her. He was so disappointed when she wasn't there. And I was like, buddy, I'm disappointed Michelle Williams isn't in my room either. But the third segment, which has, it's all in Montana. It's a Kelly Reichardt film. So it's quiet, introspective. It's not a lot of outward acting, a lot of internal acting, which is my personal, like, I like watching that more. I like to see the eyes and the mouth and the face and everything like that. The third segment, which has Lily Gladstone as sort of this quiet, butchy rancher who goes into this school, just sees people going into the school, goes into school, sits down in a night class for, I think school law or something, like something to do with, like, law. And the teacher is Kristen Stewart. And she grows infatuated with Kristen Stewart. And it is such a perfect segment of the film. It's the last segment. Like, they touch on the other two again, but, like, it's the last bit. It's what you remember. And the two of them, there's a scene where they're in a parking lot, and they're talking to each other. And everything is going unsaid. Except with Lily Gladstone, there's one line that breaks my heart. And I'm going to say it for you, because the way that she delivers it, it's going to be, like, a whole different line. I just knew that if I didn't drive here, I wasn't going to see you again. And you can see everything written on her face. And then it cuts to Kristen Stewart, on their face, excuse me. And it cuts to Kristen Stewart, you see everything written on her face. And it cuts back to Lily Gladstone, and you just see them. You just see them, though. And I just want to say, I don't know. Lily Gladstone goes by both she, her, and they, them. And try and use they, them. It's actually very fascinating. I encourage you to read up on her reasoning for that, because she's Indigenous. And she's talked about, they've talked about how using both pronouns is sort of their way of decolonizing gender for themselves, which I think is really fantastic, for, like really interesting to talk, think about. But it's what I think makes both of them so great. I would love to see the two of them, Lily and Kristen, in another movie together, because what makes the two of them so great is that they both do that. So, like, you can put them both in a Kelly Reichardt film, which operates on that frequency already. Like, you're not getting that if you put them in, like, a, you know, a bigger movie. But you put them in something like that, it's just two people looking at each other, and you can read everything on their faces. I love them both so much. So, yeah, if you are like me, if you love Lily Gladstone, I'm going to try and watch The Unknown Country. I'm hoping to see Fancy Dance as soon as it's available. Lily's got a few more projects, including a project with literally Charlie Kaufman, which kind of rocks. Like, and Charlie Kaufman has written quite a few people to Oscar nominations, so hopefully, because he's not directing this one, it's being directed by Reed Moreno, who I found out is dating Tim Robbins. That was very confusing to me, mind-blowing, and I just have to share it, because I saw it and I was like, oh my god. But yeah, hopefully it's good. They've got another movie with Erica Tremblay, who directed Fancy Dance, I believe. Is that that or The Unknown Country? One of those two is directed by Erica Tremblay. She's directing Lily again in Jazzy, which I have no idea what that's about, but it looks interesting. Lily's going to be in a Hulu series. I sound like I'm Lily Gladstone's agent. They're going to be in a Hulu series with Riley Keough called Under the Bridge. Looks really interesting, based on a true story, true crime sort of situation. And then they've apparently got this biopic somewhere in the pipeline about a jazz singer whose name is, I believe, Mildred Bailey. Very interested to see that. But yeah, it's a nice bridge point between the Oscars and then also, I'm hoping to see tomorrow what I almost certainly assume will be next week's movie minute. Love Lies Bleeding, which looks bonkers, and I'm very excited for it. So, thank you so much for listening. If you've enjoyed this show, I assume you subscribe to Home Run Applesauce with all of our other wonderful shows, from Complex to Queens, A Pod of Their Own, Today Your Love, Tomorrow the World series. If you enjoy that, I encourage you to go to homerunapplesauce.com, or there will be, believe there's a link in the description for this, but even if there's not, go to homerunapplesauce.com, easiest website in the world. There's going to be a link that says Patreon. You click on that. $5 a month gets you access to exclusive episodes, monthly playlists, our Discord server, other fun stuff. $5 a month. It's not that much. And that money, I guarantee you, does actually come directly back to us. You know, we share it amongst everyone. I've seen the checks. I've gotten them. They exist. They're real. Also, you can follow this show on Twitter at FIBpod, on Instagram at FlushingIsBurningPod, and you can email us at FlushingIsBurning@gmail.com. I'd love to hear from people. You know, just thoughts, feelings, anything you want to send me any information. You have a movie record? I would love movie recommendations, because I don't know if you know, my movie taste is sort of very all over the place, and I'd love to hear if there's something I haven't seen. I'd love to be put on to something. So if there's something you'd like, feel free to share. Yeah, thank you for listening, and I will be back next week with who knows what.